So, hello. We continue our reading then of chapter 17, The Progress to Knowledge, God, Man, and Nature. Sri Aurobindo opened the chapter with a description of the involution of Satchit Ananda and its opening stages of evolution. And we, the human, or humanity, has a great role to play in the evolution of the cosmos, because it is through us that the universe begins to know itself, that knowledge is acquired, at first only an instrumental kind of knowledge, but increasingly deeper and deeper perceptions into the nature of matter, life, and mind obtain. And we have the possibility of evolving to a point that we become aware of the truth of our own individuality, not simply aware of the external nature of the ego construct, and can, therefore, fulfill ourselves in terms of the evolution and exceed ourselves. We are limited in scope, vision, power, but were the walls of the ego to come down and we to become one with the cosmos and allow its larger energies to pour through us, to open to the transcendent reality from which both universe and individual come, then a greater outflowering is possible, one in which the individual can have a crucial impact on the evolution of the universe. So our role is of immense importance. Sri Aurobindo has talked about, in an opening way, the three terms of existence that we have to deal with: the individual, the cosmos, both individual and cosmos, manifest that which is transcendent, are aspects of the supreme reality. And he has been describing what is that Godhead. And that if we pursue the truth of the individual or of the universe alone or exclusively, or even in their pairing, we would fail to reach the all-embracing truth which the Supreme is, because both are grounded in that which exceeds. So he was in the middle of this when we paused last time. So let's take up the paragraph that comes next. Yet even this absolute he cannot really affirm by itself and to the exclusion of the two other categories. For then he has only made a violent leap away from the problem he is here to solve. And he himself and the cosmos remain an inexplicable mystification or a purposeless mystery. So we can't turn to the transcendent only. We leap away from the crux of the problem that's at the heart of the individual existing and moving within the cosmos. We have to truly resolve it. A certain part of his intellect and his longing for rest may be placated by such a solution, just as his physical intelligence is easily satisfied by a denial of the beyond and a deification of material nature. But his heart, his will, the strongest and intensest parts of his being remain without a meaning, void of purpose or justification, or become merely a random foolishness agitating itself like a vain and restless shadow against the eternal repose of the pure existence, or amidst the eternal inconscience of the universe. As for the cosmos, it remains there in the singular character of a carefully constructed lie of the infinite, a monstrously aggressive and yet really non-existent anomaly, a painful and miserable paradox with false shows of wonder and beauty and delight. This, he writes, if we gave soul affirmation to the transcendent and took our eyes and our hearts off and out of the universe and our puzzling presence here. Or else, it is a huge play of blind, organized energy without significance, and his own being a temporary, minute anomaly incomprehensibly occurring in that senseless vastness. That way, no satisfying fulfillment lies for the consciousness, the energy that has manifested itself in the world and in man. The mind needs to find something that links all together, something by which nature is fulfilled in man and man in nature, and both find themselves in God, because the divine is ultimately self-revealed in both man and nature. So the mind in the human seeks a synthetic solution, placing nature and the individual in the transcendent, in the supreme. An acceptance, a perception of the unity of these three categories is essential to the knowledge. It is towards their unity, as well as their integrality, that the growing self-consciousness of the individual opens out, and at which it must arrive if it is to be satisfied of itself and complete. For without the realization of unity, the knowledge of none of the three can be entire. Their unity is for each the condition of its own integrality. It is again by knowing each in its completeness that all three meet in our consciousness and become one. It is in a total knowledge that all knowing becomes one and indivisible. Otherwise, it is only by division and rejection of two of them from the third that we can get at any kind of oneness. So a higher knowledge alone can unify all three, the human, the universe, and the divine transcendence. And this realization must become real in power as well as in cognition. This has got to be a knowledge that we can do something with. And incorporating all terms into a large synthetic whole is necessary, because otherwise, if we affirm only one, we deny the other two. If we affirm the transcendent, we've seen that the universe and the individual are denied. If we transfer our allegiance to the universe, then God and the individual can be denied. If we only reflect upon ourselves and say, we are mighty and all the rest is unworthy, then I think we hardly need to go there. So, otherwise, let's read this again. It is only by division and rejection of two of them from the third that we could get at any kind of oneness. Man therefore has to enlarge his knowledge of himself, his knowledge of the world, and his knowledge of God until in their totality he becomes aware of their mutual indwelling and oneness. Universe and individual are in God and are one with the divine. The divine dwells in the individual. The divine dwells in the universe, and oneness results from that as well. He continues, "For so long as he knows them only in part, there will be an incompleteness resulting in division. And so long as he has not realized them in a reconciling unity, he will not have found their total truth or the fundamental significances of existence." So, this would be the secret meaning of a true Advaita, a true non-dualism that insists on the affirmation of all in each and of each in all and of the entirety of the whole. The Supreme is transcendent, universal, and individual. This is not to say that the Supreme is not self-existent and self-sufficient. God exists in himself, and not by virtue of the cosmos or of man, while man and cosmos exist by virtue of God and not in themselves, except insofar as their being is one with the being of God. We have not asserted otherwise. But still, they are a manifestation of the power of God, and even in his eternal existence, their spiritual reality must in some way be present or implied, since otherwise there would be no possibility of their manifestation or manifested, they would have no significance. So it is the presence of that Supreme in universe and individual which render them significant. They don't exist in and of themselves. They don't bring themselves into being. They depend upon, literally, this Supreme Reality. What appears here as man is an individual being of the divine. The divine extended in multiplicity is the self of all individual existences. And here we have a quote from the Katha Upanishad. Eko vashi sarva bhutantaratma. And this is the translation of it. Moreover, it is through the knowledge of self and the world that man arrives at the knowledge of God, and he cannot attain to it otherwise. It is not by rejecting God's manifestation, but by rejecting his own ignorance of it and the results of his ignorance, that he can best lift up and offer the whole of his being and consciousness and energy and joy of being into the divine existence. He doesn't insist upon it, but the way he's expressed it here, awake to the truth of the individual, then to the truth of the universe, and then to the truth of the transcendence. Because you can't really know the fullness of any until you have climbed the ladder and got back to the origin of all. He may do this through himself, one manifestation, or he may do it through the universe, another manifestation. Arriving through himself alone, it is possible for him to plunge into an individual emergence or absorption in the indefinable and to lose the universe. Now here we're talking about affirming the transcendence. So one could erase the individual in the experience of that. But he says, no. Arriving through the individual alone, he can sink his individuality either in the impersonality of universal being or in a dynamic self of universal conscious force. He merges into the universal self or he becomes an impersonal channel of the cosmic energy. So in the one, we may erase ourselves in the transcendence, disappear individuality absorbed into the oceanic reality above. Or we can likewise lose the individuality in the cosmic mass. There's a third option as well. Arriving through the equal integrality of both and seizing through them and beyond them on all the aspects of the divine, he exceeds both and fulfills them in that exceeding. He possesses the divine in his being, even as he is enveloped, penetrated, pervaded, possessed by the divine being, consciousness, light, power, delight, knowledge. He possesses God in himself and God in the universe. The all knowledge justifies to him its creation of himself and justifies by him perfected its creation of the world it has made. So this is the integral. So there's realization of that can be of the self alone, it can be of the cosmic consciousness, or it can be integral in which there is a consonance in the affirmation of all, finding the same truth in each. So in this last, in this integrality, you find the justification of your own individual being, that yes, you are here, really you are, and there is a purpose in your being here. And through your knowledge of your deeper self, you can find the perfection necessary for the world too. So the universe is justified in the awakened and liberated soul who has self-knowledge. All this, he writes, becomes entirely real and effective by an ascension into a supramental and supreme supernature and the descent of its powers into the manifestation. But even while that consummation is still difficult and distant, the true knowledge can be made subjectively real by a spiritual reflection or reception in mind, life, body, nature. So this grand realization in which individual and universe are affirmed in the transcendence, one can have as an experience. You can have it as a reality in your subjective being. It is reflected, as he says here, spiritually in nature. This is different from the reality that would be empowered were the supramental consciousness to manifest in the individual in nature. So we can have it, but in a sense it's at one remove. A point he makes also in the synthesis of yoga. There he speaks about the experience of Satchit Ananda as being reflected in our being. We don't get it as it is in Satchit Ananda above because we are experiencing it here, but something of that reality is reflected in our nature. But this spiritual truth and true aim of his being is not allowed to appear till late in his journey. For the early preparatory business of man and the evolutionary steps of nature is to affirm, to make distinct and rich, to possess firmly, powerfully, and completely his own individuality. So this great concordant realization where we know the truth of our essential being, its dynamic force moving and operating and ascending in consciousness in the world, the reality of the cosmos around being the ground in which we are moving and self-same with it. We are the instrument through which the cosmos awakens, and drawing and seeing the reality of both situated in that vast, transcendent, supreme, that is a rather far stage of the journey, even though it's preparatory to getting to the supramental. The first thing that we have to do is to grow a big, fat, strong ego. As a consequence, he has, in the beginning, principally to occupy himself with his own ego. In this egoistic phase of his evolution, the world and others are less important to him than himself, are indeed only important as aids and occasions for his self-affirmation. God, too, at this stage, is less important to him than he is to himself, and therefore, in earlier formations, on the lower levels of religious development, God or the gods are treated as if they existed for man, as supreme instruments for the satisfaction of his desires, his helpers in his task of getting the world in which he lives to satisfy his needs and wants and ambitions. Now, we can see this in the liturgy of every religion, that if I pray hard enough and offer enough sacrifices, then by golly, I expect the bounty of heaven to come to me. This primary egoistic development, with all its sins and violences and crudities, is by no means to be regarded in its proper place as an evil or an error of nature. It is necessary for man's first work, the finding of his own individuality and its perfect disengagement from the lower subconscient in which the individual is overpowered by the mass consciousness of the world and entirely subject to the mechanical workings of nature. So it is through the machinery of the ego that we climb out of that muck and can stand up and say, I am. Man, the individual, has to affirm, to distinguish his personality against nature, to be powerfully himself, to evolve all his human capacities of force and knowledge and enjoyment, so that he may turn them upon her and upon the world with more and more mastery and force. His self-discriminating egoism is given him as a means for this primary purpose. I don't know if we should rush in here and say that there is a point in our individual and social development where perhaps that kind of egoistic insistence is not necessary anymore. Until he has thus developed his individuality, his personality, his separate capacity, he cannot be fit for the greater work before him or successfully turn his faculties to higher, larger, and more divine ends. He has to affirm himself in the ignorance before he can perfect himself in the knowledge. Now, this passage here is largely the same as you would find in the pages of the Aria where this was first written. It's interesting, he does not call here upon a couple of verses from the Isha Upanishad, which he might have done. Quote, he who knows that as both in one, the knowledge and the ignorance, by the ignorance crosses beyond death, mortality, and by the knowledge enjoys immortality. So the necessity, that's verse 11, so the necessity of going through the ignorance to get to the knowledge, insisted upon by the Isha Upanishad. And in an earlier verse too, but he who sees everywhere the self in all existences, and all existences in the self, shrinks not thereafter from aught, from anything. That's verse 6. Now we get to a paragraph which he seems to have well, basically inserted. And it's a very interesting paragraph and will lead to more discussion later on in the final chapters of the book. For the initiation of the evolutionary emergence from the inconscient works out by two forces, a secret cosmic consciousness and an individual consciousness manifest on the surface. The secret cosmic consciousness remains secret and subliminal to the surface individual. It organizes itself on the surface by the creation of separate objects and beings, suggesting that we'll get lost when we stay in the apparent part of our personality, floating around in that stuff. But there is a consciousness unseen, occult, secret, and subliminal, behind the line of our awareness. And remember, that's where all these worlds, the inner mind, the inner life, and the inner physical all meet in a vaster way. But while it organizes the separate object and the body and mind of the individual, it creates also collective powers of consciousness, which are large subjective formations of cosmic nature. But it does not provide for them an organized mind and body. It bases them on the group of individuals, develops for them a group mind, a changing yet continuous group body. So here he begins to talk about the collective consciousness as something which we ought to regard and which nature, in her secrecy, has been engineering and organizing. It follows that only as the individuals become more and more conscious can the group being also become more and more conscious. The growth of the individual is the indispensable means for the inner growth as distinguished from the outer force and expansion of the collective being. This, indeed, is the dual importance of the individual, that it is through him that the cosmic spirit organizes its collective units and makes them self-expressive and progressive, and through him that it raises nature from the inconscient to the superconscient and exalts it to meet the transcendent. So, the individual growth enables the collective advance into the universal and transcendent states of being. In the mass, the collective consciousness is near to the inconscient. It has a subconscious, an obscure and mute movement which needs the individual to express it, to bring it to light, to organize it, and make it effective. The mass consciousness by itself moves by a vague, half-formed or unformed subliminal and commonly subconscient impulse rising to the surface. It is prone to a blind or half-seeing unanimity which suppresses the individual in the common movement. If it thinks, it is by the motto, the slogan, the watchword, the common crude or formed idea, the traditional, the accepted customary notion. It acts when not by instinct or on impulse, then by the rule of the pack, the herd mentality, the type law. This mass consciousness, life, action, can be extraordinarily effective if it can find an individual or a few powerful individuals to embody, express, lead, organize it. Its sudden crowd movements can also be irresistible for the moment, like the motion of an avalanche or the rush of a tempest. The subordination of the individual in the mass consciousness can give a great practical efficiency to a nation or a community If the subliminal collective being can build a binding tradition or find a group, a class, a head to embody its spirit and direction, the strength of powerful military states, of communities with a tense and austere culture rigidly imposed on its individuals, the success of the great world conquerors had behind it this secret of nature. But this is an efficiency of the outer life, and that life is not the highest or last term of our being. There is a mind in us. There is a soul and spirit, and our life has no true value if it has not in it a growing consciousness, a developing mind. And if life and mind are not an expression, an instrument, a means of liberation and fulfillment for the soul, the indwelling spirit. So it looks, on the face of it, that Sri Aurobindo's consideration of the collective has grown in importance since the years he had written the Arya, because remember, there came into formation after the mother's return from Japan on the 24th of April, 1920, the growth of a group of people around him into a living, breathing, dynamically expanding ashram. And also, he could not help but consider what is happening in the world around, how politics was shaping the destiny of the globe. And it looks as if you might have taken into consideration here on the collective the notations of the phenomena of Hitler and Mussolini, and needed to insert this as a substantial revision to the way the chapter stood earlier. But the progress of the mind, the growth of the soul, even of the mind and soul of the collectivity, depends on the individual, on his sufficient freedom and independence, on his separate power to express and bring into being what is still unexpressed in the mass, still undeveloped from the subconscious, or not yet brought out from within or brought down from the superconscious. Note the stress on what the individual must do here in maintaining freedom and independence. Must be able to demarcate itself from the subconscious nature of the mass consciousness, so as to carve out a path for the future development and evolution of the race and through the race of the world. The collectivity is a mass, a field of formation. The individual is the diviner of truth, the form maker, the creator. In the crowd, the individual loses his inner direction and becomes a cell of the mass body, moved by the collective will or idea or the mass impulse. He has to stand apart, affirm his separate reality in the whole, his own mind emerging from the common mentality, his own life distinguishing itself in the common life uniformity, even as his body has developed something unique and recognizable in the common physicality. He has, even in the end, to retire into himself in order to find himself. And it is only when he has found himself that he can become spiritually one with all. If he tries to achieve that oneness in the mind, in the vital, in the physical, and has not yet a sufficiently strong individuality, he may be overpowered by the mass consciousness and lose his soul fulfillment, his mind fulfillment, his life fulfillment, become only a cell of the mass body. So first, one has to develop the sense of individuality and separate it, if necessary, from the mass so as to hone it, to shape it, to bring it towards perfection. And then, if necessary, to dwell upon it interiorly. Even if it requires something of a temporary divorce from the world around, so that one can bring forward its many-sided nature, because we are not simply an individual in form, but we are an individual in consciousness as well. We have to find, refine, expand, harmonize. He continues, the collective being may then become strong and dominant, but it is likely to lose its plasticity, its evolutionary movement. The great evolutionary periods of humanity have taken place in communities where the individual became active, mentally, vitally, or spiritually alive. For this reason, nature invented the ego, that the individual might disengage himself from the unconscious or subconscious of the mass and become an independent living mind, life power, soul, spirit, coordinating himself with the world around him, but not drowned in it and separately inexistent and ineffective. For the individual is indeed part of the cosmic being, but he is also something more. He is a soul that has descended from the transcendence. This he cannot manifest at once, because he is too near to the cosmic inconscience, not near enough to the original superconscience. He has to find himself as the mental and vital ego before he can find himself as the soul or spirit. Everything at its appropriate stage. Still, to find his egoistic individuality is not to know himself. The true spiritual individual is not the mind ego, the life ego, the body ego. Predominantly, this first movement is a work of will, of power, of egoistic self-effectuation, and only secondarily of knowledge. Force first, knowledge next. Therefore, a time must come when man has to look below the obscure surface of his egoistic being and attempt to know himself. He must set out to find the real man. Without that, he would be stopping short at nature's primary education and never go on to her deeper and larger teachings. However great his practical knowledge and efficiency, he would be only a little higher than the animals. First, he has to turn his eyes upon his own psychology and distinguish its natural elements, ego, mind, and its instruments, life, body, until he discovers that his whole existence stands in need of an explanation other than the working of the natural elements and of a goal for its activities other than an egoistic self-affirmation and satisfaction. So this is the search for the deeper soul behind. He may seek it in nature and mankind, and thus start on his way to the discovery of his unity with the rest of his world. He may seek it in supernature, in God, and thus start on his way to the discovery of his unity with the divine. Practically, he attempts both paths and, continually wavering, continually seeks to fix himself in the successive solutions that may be best in accordance with the various partial discoveries he has made on his double line of search and finding. Trying to explain ourselves in terms of cosmos, trying to explain ourselves in terms of our divine origin in God. but we vacillate. We go back and forth. But through it all, what he is in this stage, still insistently seeking to discover, to know, to fulfill, is himself. His knowledge of nature, his knowledge of God, are only helps towards self-knowledge, towards the perfection of his being, towards the attainment of the supreme object of his individual self-existence. You've been given a riddle. Yourself is your riddle. You must solve it at the profoundest depths and then bring that solution forward to change the way the nature expresses it. Directed towards nature and the cosmos, it may take upon itself the figure of self-knowledge, self-mastery in the mental and vital sense, and mastery of the world in which we find ourselves. Directed towards God, it may take also this figure, but in a higher spiritual sense of world and self. Or it may assume that other, so familiar and decisive to the religious mind, the seeking for an individual salvation, whether in heavens beyond, or by a separate emergence in a supreme self or a supreme non-self, beatitude or nirvana. So heaven, moksha, or nirvana, but away from this. Throughout, however, it is the individual who is seeking individual self-knowledge and the aim of his separate existence, with all the rest, even altruism and the love and service of mankind, self-effacement or self-annihilation thrown in, with whatever subtle disguises, as helps and means towards that one great preoccupation of his realized individuality. This may seem to be only an expanded egoism, and the separative ego would then be the truth of man's being, persistent in him to the end, or till at last he is liberated from it by his self-extinction in the featureless eternity of the infinite. But there is a deeper secret behind which justifies his individuality and its demand, the secret of the spiritual and eternal individual, the Purusha. So, we may seek God, we may seek salvation for the world, but it is a cloak for our ego. There seems to be, to the casual viewer, a supreme egoism even in those seekings, until we arrive at this deeper secret of the real soul, the conscious person inside, the Purusha. I think this is a good place to put a bookmark, and we intend to finish the chapter next week. So I think I have a passage from Savitri tonight, which will be luminous and fitting for our purposes. It's in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. We are always beginning, aren't we? This is in Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. Immortally, she conceives herself in him. In the creature, the unveiled creatrix works. Her face is seen through his face, her eyes through his eyes. Her being is his through a vast identity. Then is revealed in man the overt divine. A static oneness and dynamic power descend in him, the integral Godhead's seals. His soul and body take that splendid stamp. A long, dim preparation is man's life, a circle of toil and hope and war and peace, tracked out by life on matter's obscure ground. In his climb to a peak no feet have ever trod, he seeks through a penumbra shot with flame, a veiled reality half known, ever missed, a search for something or someone never found, cult of an ideal never made real here, an endless spiral of ascent and fall, until at last is reached the giant point through which his glory shines for whom we were made, and we break into the infinity of God. Across our nature's borderline we escape into supernature's arc of living light. This now was witnessed in that sun of force, in him that high transition laid its base, original and supernal immanence of which all nature's process is the art. The cosmic worker set his secret hand to turn this frail mud engine to heaven use. A presence wrought behind the ambiguous screen. It beat his soil to bear a titan's weight, refining half-hewn blocks of natural strength. It built his soul into a statued god. The craftsman of the magic stuff of self, who labors at his high and difficult plan in the wide workshop of the wonderful world, modeled in inward time his rhythmic parts. Then came the abrupt transcendent miracle. The masked immaculate grandeur could outline, at travail in the occult womb of life, his dreamed magnificence of things to be. A crown of the architecture of the worlds, a mystery of married earth and heaven, and next divinity to the mortal scheme. A seer was born, a shining guest of time. For him, mind's limiting firmament seized above. In the griffin forefront of the night and day, a gap was rent in the all-concealing vault. The conscious ends of being went rolling back. The landmarks of the little person fell. The island ego joined its continent. Overpassed was this world of rigid, limiting forms. Life's barriers opened into the unknown. Abolished were conception's covenants, and striking off subjection's rigorous claws, annulled the soul's treaty with nature's nescience. All the gray inhibitions were torn off and broken the intellect's hard and lustrous lid. Truth unpartitioned found immense sky room. An empyrean vision saw and knew. The bounded mind became a boundless light, the finite self mated with infinity. His march now soared into an eagle's flight. Out of apprenticeship to ignorance, wisdom upraised him to her master craft and made him an archmason of the soul, a builder of the immortal secret house, an aspirant to supernal timelessness. Freedom and empire called to him from on high. Above mind's twilight and life's star-led night, there gleamed the dawn of a spiritual day. Thank you for being with us as always. Namaste. Jai Ma.